Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurant.guysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing good, man. Doing well.
You know, we mentioned an email recently on the show from a gentleman named Ed in Toronto. And
we promised you we'd talk more about it, and it seems like, based on the emails that we've gotten from you.
Emails beget emails, it seems. We've heard from a lot of restaurateurs who listen to the show, and we're thrilled, actually, that so many restaurateurs listen to the show, or people in the restaurant business, or people who are foolish enough to be considering
the contemplating
business.
The restaurant business. Those are the people we're really about to talk
despite
to.
Despite our best efforts, you're still thinking about it. Here's the email from Ed. I listen to the show regularly. Great job. I have apparently taken leave of my faculties, left my real job to open a restaurant. Thanks for the honest speak and some great nuggets of wisdom. No, really, Ed, Toronto, Canada. Okay, Ed.
Ed, I'm going to give you one more nugget. Go back. Go back. That's what I'm telling you.
What people have asked us for is they say, you know, you say there are all these crazy things you don't think of, and they mm-hmm. enjoy the things, that sort of the aha moments that they get when we talk about weird stuff that happens. But, you know, all of this weird stuff, it is a business when it comes right down to it. And I do this business because I have to. I love it. I adore the business. I love every part of it, or almost every part of it. But when we talk about these funny stories about, oh, no, that thing happened, remember, when I say, oh, and then the sewage ejector pump went. Well, yeah, that meant that I had to spend an afternoon last July cleaning fixing the sewage ejector, but it also meant I had to buy a new sewage ejector pump.
I spent $8,000 on a new sewage ejector pump.
You know.
It's one of the things that Francis kind of our maxim for anybody who comes to us whenever they're thinking about opening a restaurant or opening any kind of food establishment is go and work for somebody else. And we've talked about this before on the show. But go and work for somebody else. Go use somebody else's money.
To make the mistakes.
And make your mistakes. Because you're going to make mistakes. Just like a 17-year-old driver shouldn't, in my belief, be driving a $50,000 car. Because 17, 18-year-olds, almost all of them get into a fender bender in that first year or two of learning to drive, about learning about the limits of what they can do and what they can't do.
And I grew up with a father that did not care at all if I drove a $50,000 car when I was 17. As long as I could make enough at ChopRite to buy a $50,000
car. As long as you purchased your own
$50,000. He didn't care at all. He supported me in whatever I chose.
But even before you make the investment in culinary college, and you know, CIA is $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year to go. Some of these other colleges are only $8,000-$10,000 a year. But why not go and spend some time in someone's kitchen or someone's front of house making money, and spend a little bit of time in an apprenticeship where you can make a little bit of money and where your mistakes cost someone else instead of costing you?
You know, we have in recent history thrown out a food because some intern made it wrong.
Listen,
because our systems didn't work or didn't catch it, or our systems did work and caught
exactly,
it.
Exactly, and that's what it is. It's more our systems working and catching it. But last night, Francis and I were in the kitchen, and the chef was tasting some pasta filling, some cheese pasta filling. Well, it hadn't been salted appropriately by the prep cook who was making it. Well, what happened? All of the pasta that person had been filling had to be thrown away. I mean, now, Francis and I and the chef think of things a little differently, so we fed them to our staff.
But I had it for dinner.
But rather than that product be utilized, then it's a complete loss.
Well,
and again, that's cheese-filled pasta. It's not your most expensive item. You're lucky it's not the rack of lamb. It's not those types of things.
But the idea is to work in someone else's system.
Mm-hmm.
And we all have different systems and different ways of doing things. And that's, you know, that's what makes it work. Now, corporations have very rigid systems. Small businesses and fine dining restaurants also have systems, but you want to work for somebody whom you respect and just because you respect them doesn't mean you think they do everything right. You want to see what they do right and see what they do wrong. And usually, restaurants need and restaurateurs need and operators need help in various ways. Can I work in the office 1 or 2 days mm-hmm. a week? You know, $8 an hour, but you're working in the office and you get to see all of the stuff that happens and you get to listen. And one of the things that we say to people, to our clients all the time, because we're now taking clients again for that our second restaurant is built for restaurant consulting. And sometimes it's just, you know, we come in and do a wine list for somebody in a beverage program, but very often it's someone who says, I have a business plan, I want you to look at it, help me get through, help me get it open, help me get my extension built.
Mm-hmm.
And we always say, okay, there's a 20% contingency fee. And they say, well, that's a lot of money. I don't have that. I was like, well, then take something off the plan.
Right.
Because you're going over 20% from your pie in the sky scenario. It's a restaurant. It always goes
and
over.
It's not just a restaurant. It's a construction project. And, mm-hmm. and each of the components of a restaurant need to be treated like a business. And any construction project is going to go over budget because when you open up a wall, when you find out, just like in your home, when you find out that the windows are rotted out or there's a floor joist that needs to be replaced, you need to replace it. And most bids won't include those types of things.
And it's not just the construction project, it's the operations mm-hmm. of the restaurant. Because when you have budgeted a certain amount, you may find yourself saying, if you don't have the ability to make the repair or buy the piece of equipment you need, and you don't buy it, and you wind up producing something by hand that can be made by machine, or if you mm-hmm. wind up using a substandard piece of equipment, you're going to make food that's not as good, and it's going to cost you more on an operational and daily week than in weekly basis to make it. And you need to have contingencies. Look, a restaurant is one of the only businesses that is both a retail shop and a manufacturer. We manufacture in a mom and pop fashion,
mm-hmm.
and the exigencies and the contingencies are just incredible. I mean, look, this year we had. You get hit by all kinds of crazy things.
You have to anticipate things that there's no way to anticipate.
Utilities went up. You may say, well, how does that affect your restaurant? Well, I mean,
I'll just give you the numbers. In the last 2 years, our utilities now are up almost $20,000 more per year than they were 2 years ago. And that's based on as if the restaurant had been static in size. We've actually grown. And so there is added utilities, but they're attributed to other areas.
So that's $20,000 out of your pocket.
That's $20,000 bottom line. And the other thing, and we've talked about this, I guess, earlier in the show, like probably almost a year ago we talked about this. When you're planning a restaurant, especially a high-end restaurant, the profitability level should be and can be around 10%. Okay, 10%. That means 30% basically for salaries, 30% basically for food, and that's, you know, sometimes higher or lower, and 30% basically for all the other things, tables, chairs, heat, rent, all those other types of things. That leaves you 10%. When gas and electric takes another 2% of that, that's 20% of your profitability. And those types of things you have to plan for. I'm just going to give you another example of something tiny, 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 and how it impacts on the restaurant business. Since gas prices have gone up, a lot of people are charging, delivery people are charging a fuel surcharge. $1 here, $2 there, $3
But everything
there.
Gets delivered.
Okay, every product that I get, and because of the type of restaurant I am, I'm getting deliveries from 40 or 50 different companies a week. So it's $1 or $2 here or there, it's $60, $70 a week. Well, $60, $70 a week is $3,500, $4,000 on the bottom line. And it's a nothing. It's
right.
$1. And when you're looking at it, you're saying, oh, it's $1. But those types of things affect a restaurant.
You don't die from large wounds in the restaurant. You die from not having a plan, and you get nickeled and dimed to death. And that's the way it goes. Hey, but you know what? If you do survive and you have to do it, you should go and work for somebody else and see how all these little things happen, because you can't put it in a manual. It's too many things. Hey, listen, we're going to come back, and we're going to talk to somebody about interesting wine closures, and we're going to talk to a gentleman who opened a new and interesting, one of the most interesting diners, believe it or not, that I've seen around here in a long time. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We have with us today Laura Clark. Laura Clark works with a very large company. You know how we all often deal with estate bottled wines, small producers, little family farmers. Well, Laura's with Alcoa. That's a rather large company that is making a new kind of closure for wine bottles. You've heard us and the many winemakers we've had on the show talk about how sometimes when you use cork in a bottle of wine, while it sort of gives the image of quality, sometimes that cork can be infected, and you get a certain percentage of bottles that are bad, which is one of the reasons that the bottle is presented to you or the sommelier tastes the bottle of wine in a restaurant. And there are all sorts of different alternatives to the cork. None of them are very sexy. A lot of them don't work very well. But we came across one that we really liked, and a wine producer who we have in the restaurant coming to do a dinner, a guy named David O'Reilly, owns Shenan and Owen Rowe wineries out of Oregon. And the bottle of wine had this really cool glass stopper, believe it or not. And so we hunted down the manufacturer of that glass stopper, and here we have Laura Clark from Alcoa to talk about this. What is this thing? It's pretty.
Hi, Laura. How are you today?
Good. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing really well.
Great. Yes, it is a new alternative wine closure that we are just now introducing to North America. It originated out of our offices in Germany, and it is kind of the glass-on-glass technology associated with an old-fashioned glass decanter.
Uh-huh.
So it eliminates all the issues that are associated with traditional cork, plus it retains the elegance of an upscale closure.
You said, like a glass decanter, and that's exactly what it seems like to me. It seems like a glass decanter top, but one of the problems with your conventional decanters and how those decanters work is when you have a glass-to-glass seal, you don't get a true seal and you get a lot of air exchange.
This is true, and actually there is an O-ring associated with ours, which allows us to get a hermetic seal as well.
So it's an O-ring. What is it? What is that O-ring?
The O-ring, we have two different formulations available. The product that we're using or recommending predominantly is a PVC format, and it's a material, PVC, which is pharmaceutical grade, and that we have been using in the wine industry for over 30 years, so that we know that it is subjectively neutral and it does not impart any type of taste or odor characteristics to the wine.
Well, I want to talk just for one brief minute about why this has all come about. And those of you who listen to the show every day know about some of the issues with cork and know about some of the problems that have come about. But what's happened in the cork world, and cork is actually a tree, and what's happened is as cork has become more ubiquitous throughout the world and more people are drinking wine again, cork is a commodity, and it's a tree, and it's becoming more and more scarce.
Bark of a tree.
And it's a bark of a tree, and it's becoming more and more scarce, and it's becoming more difficult to find. And so people are using the part of the cork plant which is more likely to be infected with this bacteria called TCA. And so we're getting more and more corked bottles, and that's what we call it when it's infected with this, and it's becoming a bigger and bigger problem. And a lot of people around the world have been looking for an alternative.
So how is this being received? How is this product being received?
Fantastic. Just to give you a little bit of a history on the product, it was back in 2002 when a doctor actually in Germany approached us about the idea of using glass for wine packaging.
Mm-hmm.
And so we worked with him and some of the local wineries in the Worms, Germany area, as well as some of the universities over there to jointly develop this product. So we've been commercial since about mid-2003.
Mm-hmm.
The product was launched in Germany, and right now we have 350 wineries that are currently using this product over in Europe. And it's just fantastic. Most of the time, like when you go into a winery and you start qualifying, you have to do a couple different runs where they're allowed to take your closure and put product up for stability. So it can be a very long process because you have to allow the wine to age, and different companies do it over different periods of time.
But sure, some wines are supposed to age for 6 months,
yeah,
some wines are supposed to age for
exactly
25 years.
So you put it up, and then you have to wait a period of time, 6 months, a year or two. And then you do testing on it to make sure that there hasn't been any changes.
How long is the longest wine that's been under this glass stopper?
For over 2 years.
Wow. I think that's really interesting. It's a glass stopper that you're going to see more and more on wine bottles, I think. You can find it on David O'Reilly's wine at O'Reilly's or Shenan or Owen Rowe. And what it is it's a glass stopper on top that you can just pull off. You don't need a corkscrew. And there's a little synthetic O-ring just at the very top. So the amount of contact between the wine and that O-ring is very small. It's mostly glass on glass.
Yeah, plus that particular O-ring material we've used for wines because we make twist-offs. wine closures as well for over 30 years. So, now, I mean, it's something that's been used in the industry without it.
Is it 100% airtight seal? Because a cork is not 100% airtight seal, and a lot of winemakers like that there's some respiration through the cork.
There is, yeah. There's a lot of debate in the industry. You know, do you need to have aerobic or is anaerobic oxidation sufficient for the wine to mature and age? It is hermetic, so it is an airtight seal, just kind of like a screw cap. And I think most of the industry leaders right now, and there's going to be differencing in opinions, and, you know, the wineries know their wine best, but I think a lot of people, or the trend in the industry, is the belief that anaerobic oxidation right now is sufficient enough to age and mature a wine properly.
Interesting. We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Laura Clark of Alcoa about different kinds of wine closures. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. Welcome back. Our guest today is Laura Clark. She's with Alcoa, which is manufacturing a new kind of wine stopper, and that's what we're talking about, a replacement for cork.
So, Laura, has cork always been the preferred type of stopper for wine? I mean, it seems like as long as most of us can remember, cork is the preferred stopper.
Cork does have a long history in wine, and actually some of that dates back to Greek and Roman times. But the interesting thing is that actually following cork came different types of rope products and fabrics, but then it went into glass stoppers. So actually glass stoppers were the preferred method for sealing and packaging wine up until like the 1830s, and the stopper was traditionally called a stopple. Was used until like the 1830s, as I said, but the reason why we moved away from that and then back into cork was essentially because at that time you had to grind down the stopper so that you had the hermetic seal.
So you had a perfect seal.
Yep, so that you had the perfect seal. And sometimes that seal just got a little bit too tight and it was almost impossible to take the stopper out without breaking the bottle.
Interesting.
So this isn't something that's new to the industry necessarily. I mean, it has a long, rich history to it. And, you know, wine has been packaged in glass bottles forever.
Well, I have to tell you, the reason we called you, Laura, was because Francis and I, and as we said earlier in the show, used the wine made by David O'Reilly from his Chenin vineyard. And this we, you know, opened this Cabernet Franc that's made from Chenin, which, by the way, is a spectacular bottle of wine and obviously doing very well under your glass closure. And it was very ornate, and there was still some of the ritual
and elegance
that we restaurant owners like when we open a bottle of wine. But at the same time, no corkiness, no concern about the wine bottle being corked. Obviously, there are other problems that can happen to wine anytime. But one of the big problems that's happening to wine right now is the corkiness, and that was no longer an issue.
Anyway, we think it's really interesting about what you're doing there. I think this is probably the best alternative we've come across from our perspective, and we really like it. So thanks for being on the show. And
absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
It's been swell. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks
Bye.
Very much, Laura.
Have a great one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Now, that's pretty interesting stuff. And if you want to see it, we're going to put a link to David O'Reilly's website. His wines are great. You can pick them up at Stage Left, and he's actually going to come and do a dinner at the restaurant on the 20th. So if you want to check all that out, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com or stageleft.com.
And something we need to tell you, the Chenin wines are not inexpensive. These are $40 to $50 retail bottles. This is an expensive bottle of wine.
When we come back, we're going to talk about the most interesting new diner in Central Jersey. Yeah, stay tuned. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1130.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
You know, very often our show deals with universal topics. You've heard us talk to winemakers from all over the world and restaurateurs from all over the world and major capitals. And sometimes our show, as all restaurants are, they say all politics are local. Well, all restaurants are local. And the best kind of, most local kind of New Jersey restaurant is a diner. Joining us today is Constantine Katsifis. He owns several diners and another restaurant as well. But Mark and I wandered into his brand new place on Route 1 in Edison, New Jersey, called the Skylark Diner, and we were blown away. Constantine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark.
There is a this is a new sort of diner. Why don't you tell people how your this crazy place that you've opened differs from most diners in Jersey, the capital of dinerdom?
Well, we call it Skylark Fine Diner and Lounge.
Fine Diner?
Fine Diner. It's sort of a play on the word diner and dining.
I like it.
What we're trying to do is deliver guests a fine dining food experience with a casual atmosphere of their neighborhood diner.
One of the things that seems different, and clearly this is different than any diner I've ever been to in my life, what makes a diner a diner?
Essentially, a diner has to have two elements in order to be a diner. One, it has to serve breakfast all day. Whenever it's open, it has to have breakfast.
I do love my French toast at 1 o'clock in the morning, I have to tell you.
Exactly. You need to be able to order that. You need to have a family of four or five come in, the parents order steaks and have some chicken fingers and have someone out of the blue order pancakes or scrambled eggs. That's standard diner fare. The other item is burgers. A diner is basically measured by those two things, how good is its breakfast and how good is its burger.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's it. Those are the two basic criteria, in my mind anyway, that make a diner a diner. And then the sky's the limit. You can offer anything you like from that point forward.
Well, you know, I have to say, diners are also usually on the very affordable side of things, and they're often not really great food. It's sort of serviceable food.
A lot of things come out of the freezer in your typical diner.
Which is one of the reasons that, you know, I think when people go to diners, they like eggs, because, I mean, they're eggs, you know, it's hard to cheap out on eggs. What do they cost to begin with? But your diner, the Skylark Diner that you just opened up, you're driving down the road, and you look at it, and you see that it's this sort of retro, high design, you know, campy, fun thing going on. Why don't you tell people what it looks like and the concept behind how you put it together?
The design was from a restaurant architect near Providence, Rhode Island, who specializes in restaurant design, does a lot of diner work, also does a lot of work for some of his clients from like Disney and Atlantis down in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this doesn't look like any diner I've seen in the last 30 years, though.
Thank you. Actually, we're drawing our inspiration from about 30 years ago. The architectural inspiration is like 70s futuristic, 60s and 70s futuristic. And based on the way there was a shell of a building here already, came up with the concept because there were some buttresses off the side of the building, and the architect saw that as some wings and finished them off that way. And then he delivered a really great, fun mm-hmm. design that, you know, I've had guests come in and say, you know, I feel like I'm on vacation when I'm here.
You know, it's funny that you say that your designer came from Disney, because the best way that I could describe it, if anybody ever went to Disney when in the 70s, they had a ride called If You Had Wings. It's kind of reminiscent of that kind of Disney ride experience while you're in your establishment.
Thank you.
So I think there's a great deal of camp value to the mm-hmm. place. I think that's fun and interesting and enjoyable. You've upped the quality of food for a diner. I mean, do you find that people are happy to pay those prices for food in a diner setting?
It's interesting that you mentioned pricing. I think our pricing is really reasonable. It depends on what you're comparing us to. If
exactly.
you're comparing us to a diner, like as you mentioned, that would pull things out of a freezer, or wouldn't just go to the same effort that we do for the food, I guess then we might be pricier. We're in line with our other place, the Americana in East Windsor,
right?
Price-wise. But if you compare us to Stage Left, for example, we're very reasonable.
You know you are. I have to say.
We'll say less expensive.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you talk about, and what I think is interesting and what is great is it is diner food, and some of it's more has more aspirations than diner food. When you go to a diner in New Jersey, if you're not from around the area, and people listen to this show from all over the country, if you're not from New Jersey, when you go to a diner, you get this huge menu of stuff, and don't order any of it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? It's like, stick to the basics, the burgers, the eggs, the tail
right.
ham.
The idea in your traditional diner is you want to go to the things that, A, have to be made a la minute, and B, just aren't anything that strays.
Don't trust them to get adventurous with your steak Florentine. But you actually have really great entrees, and you've sort of put a nice little restaurant into a diner setting. In some of your literature, you say, with the food industry heading toward a fast food nation, the idea of drama paired with fresh homemade items is sort of a new idea for a diner in New Jersey. You make a reference to Fast Food Nation. Are you talking about the book Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser?
No, actually, we wrote that before the...
Really?
Yeah, that was something that we were using long before that. But well, I did read that book. It was pretty interesting.
It was an interesting book. What I see in your place, and I'll tell you, Constantine, there's no way we would, if you were just a typical New Jersey diner, we probably wouldn't have had you on the show. But the way you reach so far away from what a normal diner is, and your place is a little campy and does have a little bit of shtick to it, but it's done at such a high level, I think, that Francis and I really appreciated it as we came in.
Well, and the other thing is, Constantine, you have a liquor license, and I'm a terrible alcoholic. And I'm really not an alcoholic. But you have a liquor license in a diner, and you're open late at night. Now, Mark stopped by there. Now, we first met. We had a little meeting we had to have in the afternoon. We wanted to get out of our own restaurant, and we went to your place. And that's where we encountered each other. And it was lovely in the afternoon. But Mark stopped by on the way home last night at 11:30 at night. And you got a little vibe going on there with a little bar in there as well. That's pretty cool.
You know, people were at the bar. You got a DJ going at night, which I think is a very interesting take on the traditional diner. Obviously, clearly very different. And at the same time, your main dining room, you know, was pretty full considering you're in Edison, New Jersey at midnight on a, you know, Wednesday, Thursday night.
How does the liquor license play into the whole diner theme?
The liquor license sort of seals the deal that we are a very serious restaurant that has a little bit of a casual approach to the service, and that, you know, we like to keep it a diner so that we can offer the breakfast and the burgers all day. But we're pretty serious about what we're doing, and we're delivering a really great entertainment experience with like 6 plasmas and video mixers, and we play video clips as well as little movie clips during the and sound bites for movies and such.
I gotta ask you one thing. I had fun at your place, but it struck me that you're having fun at your place. Is that what's going on?
I'm definitely having a really good time here. This is my very best effort at what I think a diner could be.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to use the word spare no expense because that doesn't really make sense. We didn't spare any thought, for example. If we thought of it and we thought it was a good idea, we applied it. We wear our heart on our sleeve, so to speak, and really try to say, look, this is what we think a diner could be in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't it be entertaining? Why mm-hmm. can't it have really great entrees and food? Why can't it be a place that people go to dine, not just to eat a lunch or just to eat that? They're actually coming here to dine. And we deliver that with really a phenomenal staff of people.
Well, Constantine, congratulations to you on creating a new thing, because that's what you've done. You've created something completely new.
Thank you very much.
You hear us talk all the time about the highest-end restaurants in the country, and it's important, just so you know, we're not snobs, to talk about this really great thing locally. If you live in the area, you should really check it out. It's on Route 1 in Edison. Constantine, the couple times we've been there, he's been walking around. You can say hello to him as well. Thanks again, Constantine.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of The Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. You should come check out our website at restaurantguysradio.com. Also, check out the Stage Left website. We have some cool events coming up this summer, the next of which is going to be on April the 20th. David O'Reilly is coming in to do dinner at the restaurant Meijin Winemaker from Oregon. Check it out.
We were just talking to a local restaurant owner, and Francis and I have been talking about some of the trials and tribulations of opening a new restaurant, things that can go wrong, things that you're not prepared for that can go wrong.
Yeah, I got one for you here. You ready for this? This, I love this one. This is, you all know what a gastropub is. It's basically a pub that has higher aspirations and serves really good food. It's a phenomenon that started in England and Ireland and has come to the United States, and the Spotted Pig is the gastropub in New York that Mario Batali was associated with, and you can't get in there, and Philadelphia is being taken over by gastropubs. Gastropub, high-end food in a pub environment.
Yeah, it's a pub where you can get some really delicious food. And
well, I've been hearing about this new one called EU that was supposed to open, and indeed just has opened on East 4th Street in Manhattan. But I love this piece in the article that I saw by Florence Fabricant in last Wednesday's New York Times. The EU, having been turned down for a liquor license, Bob Giraldi and Jason Hennings will open their East Village gastropub on Friday on a BYOB basis.
Let me help everybody. Pub?
Gastro pub, no liquor license?
That's a gastro nub.
That's a gastro nothing. Sorry. Anyway, the food sounds good.
You need a liquor license to open a gastro pub.
It's a gastro counter.
You're just a teeny little liquor license restaurant.
235 East 4th Street. I hear the food is really good. You can check it out if you're in Manhattan, and hopefully they'll get a liquor license. You can bring your own.
We really want them. You can bring your own right now.
Right.
We really hope they get a liquor license.
Good luck to you, Bob Giraldi and Jason Hennings. I hope you survive that and they give you the darn liquor license. And, you know, bring a bottle of wine. It's hard to find a bring your own in Manhattan, so you go and support them while you can. 235 East 4th Street. Check it out. It's called the EU. You can find a link to it on our website. That's what we'll do to help them out. Hey, listen, I hope you enjoyed the hour talking to the restaurant guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the restaurant guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12.